Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. The theme of this week's biennial Indian Law Symposium, hosted by the USD School of Law, is Public Safety in Indian Country. And this year's events focus on public safety, the protection of women, and the Tribal Law and Order Act, signed by President Obama 4 years ago. The symposium gets underway this evening with a keynote address by U.S. Attorney Brendan Johnson. Frank Pommersheim is USD law professor and a tribal appellate court judge. He's helping lead the events this year. He's with us here in the studio. And Professor Pommersheim, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Mike over there.
All right. Thank you.
Now, how long has the Indian Law Symposium been going on?
Well, it's amazing. We've had Indian Law Symposiums going every other year, going back all the way back to 1989, so almost a quarter, 20-plus years.
20-plus years. Yeah. Is there a purpose or a point, or what is it that you hope to accomplish during the symposium?
Well, during this symposium in particular, there are important issues that exist in Indian Country around public safety. Periodically, there are always concerns about public safety in Indian Country. There's been some recent federal legislation in two regards, the Tribal Law and Order Act and the amendments to the Violence Against Women Act that hopefully will change some very significant positive changes in the context of public safety in Indian Country. And so we wanted to present these issues to a general public to keep them better informed about issues and things that are happening in Indian Country.
The Tribal Law and Order Act, as mentioned, was signed by the president 4 years ago. At this point, how has it been implemented, and have we seen much of a change in?
Well, I would say slowly but surely. The key ingredients of the Tribal Law and Order Act is kind of an opt-in provision, because one of the concerns periodically in Indian Country is that pursuant to the Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968, the maximum sentence that a tribal court can impose in a criminal case is 1 year in jail. And so the thinking has developed that that's very limiting, because sometimes very serious crimes do occur in Indian Country, but they're not prosecuted by the federal government. And with a relatively weak sanction of only 1 year in jail, tribes have often felt hobbled in the context of advancing public safety in Indian Country. So one of the main ingredients of the Tribal Law and Order Act is if a tribe meets certain conditions, it can now sentence someone, an Indian person who's convicted in tribal court, to up to 3 years in prison. And so the thinking is there, with that enhanced sentencing capability for a tribal court, it will allow a local tribal institution, at least in theory, to have more control over public safety, because it has more potential authority to impose on people who are convicted in tribal court. But again, it's not mandatory. It's optional. And if tribes are going to try an Indian person under the Tribal Law and Order Act, they have to meet additional requirements that ordinarily they don't have to meet in tribal court. That is, the defendant in this case would have a mandatory right to a law-trained attorney. It would be a mandatory requirement that the trial judge in this particular case would have to have to be legally trained himself or herself. The law under which that person is being charged would have to be transparent and publicly available, have to have the correct procedural rules in place. And so, yes, it's an opportunity for tribes, but it doesn't automatically come their way unless they make the optional decision to ensure that these additional protections are put in place.
Has it been implemented or in South Dakota?
I don't think so. I think a number of tribes are definitely thinking about doing it, but I do not think there's actually been any prosecutions yet under the enhancement possibilities.
What about the rest of the U.S.? Do you know?
Yeah, a number of tribes are beginning to do it. I think it's been relatively slow to kind of catch on, because, one, it raises the question that a tribe has to have the resources to do this. That is, if they're going to have to provide an attorney, a law-trained attorney, well, with that responsibility, is that they're going to have to pay that person. And so there are resource issues that come up from tribes in taking the step in terms of going forward.
The topic of public safety in Indian country and law enforcement. How complicated is that? Because you're dealing with this patchwork of tribal, state, and federal jurisdictions.
Well, I think that's exactly it. I think that's what creates some of the problems about public safety is that you have responsibilities for the three overlapping sovereigns. The federal government has responsibility. The tribe itself has significant responsibility. In some cases, the state has responsibility. So one of the questions about public safety is how can you get these three sovereigns to, one, agree on what their responsibilities are and then coordinate and harmonize their responses to be most effective in advancing public safety in Indian country, because it's no place else except Indian country where you have three separate sovereigns who have different levels of responsibility, and it takes a significant amount of work to get everybody on the same page.
How often does that happen, or does it really depend on where and the interest of the parties involved as far as making that communication to make those steps for that cooperation?
Well,
to work?
I think that's absolutely critical. There are two parts. There's the resource issue. How much resources does each one of the sovereigns have to put into play in the context of public safety? And two, what is the kind of level of respect and coordination that exists between these three sovereigns? And I think as to the latter, and I do think it's improving, you know, I think historically throughout Indian country, and particularly here in South Dakota, there have been some bumpy issues about the level of understanding, respect, and cooperation between the three sovereigns. And I think all the people, all the leadership that's currently in place at the tribal level, the state level, and the federal level are interested in working more closely together. And in some sense, the symposium will provide an opportunity for representatives from all three of those sovereigns to talk about what they are doing, what they think still needs to be done. So one of the benefits of the symposium is actually to provide a forum for representatives of the three sovereigns to come together and speak about these important issues. Because I can guarantee you that the one thing all three sovereigns agree on is that there are problems concerning public safety in Indian country. Where the differences begin to creep in is what is the response that ought to be made and what is the response that is required by each one of the sovereigns.
And when you talk about each one of those sovereigns, I imagine that to get anywhere, there has to be trust and respect from all sides.
Absolutely. From my point of view, that's the absolute prerequisite. It's the absolute predicate to kind of going forward. People have to know and respect each other. And part of it is historical. Part of it is just sort of the geography. You know, the federal government, which has very significant public safety responsibilities in Indian country, they have no presence in Indian country. The U.S. Attorney's Office, and Brendan Johnson's done a terrific job, they don't have any ongoing presence in Indian country. There's not a single FBI office in Indian country in South Dakota. And so, yeah, the feds have a lot of responsibility, but they're kind of far away. The state has a certain amount of responsibility, particularly in the context of non-Indians, because it's often in very rural parts of South Dakota. Their own presence is somewhat minimal, and sometimes there is friction or fractiousness between the presence of potentially state law enforcement officers on the reservation, and the tribe itself oftentimes doesn't have as large a law enforcement capability as they would like to have. So there are some problems that are a result of history. There's a problems as a result of these overlapping sovereigns, and there are problems of geography.
Professor Pommersheim, what has been your role as an appellate tribal judge?
Well, I've served on a number of tribal appellate courts throughout Indian country, and particularly here in South Dakota. I'm currently on and have been on for a long time. The Rosebud Sioux Supreme Court, the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Court of Appeals, and the Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribal Court of Appeals. And on the appellate courts, we deal with important issues that come up involving the tribes themselves, participating parties, you know, like cases come up, well, how much authority, civil jurisdiction do tribal courts have over non-Indians or non-Indians who are doing business on the reservation? Occasionally we do have cases involving law enforcement in Indian country. What are the rights of Indian defendants in tribal court? Do they have the right to counsel? Do some of the standard things in terms of search and seizure and Miranda actually apply? So those kind of things. And, you know, Tribal appellate courts are an early part of their history. So just like the United States Supreme Court, when it was first starting, was making important decisions in what are called cases of first impression. Oftentimes that's what tribal appellate courts are doing, is trying to make some significant decisions in important areas of the law to set kind of a framework or a groundwork for people going forward to understand, okay, these are the rules that apply here, and everyone, both civilly and criminally, can adjust their conduct accordingly.
This must be probably, it sounds like every time I read about law enforcement in Indian country, most complex places to for law, for studying law, for enforcing law. There's so many, as I think we've been talking about, there's just so many different levels and so many different sovereigns, as we said, involved. It seems like it's hard sometimes to make sense of it and how it all works.
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The complex nature of the problem is itself part of the problem. You can ask any one of the three sovereigns, is this the way it ought to be? And each one of the sovereigns will agree, no, this is kind of troubling, difficult, crazy to kind of figure out. So there's an agreement that it is not very rational, that it is problematic, so there is convergence there. But when you ask each sovereign what the solution to this complex legal historical issue, there's less common ground about how to solve this problem. There is an agreement that there is a problem, which is good. It's necessary. It's the predicate. And I think we're beginning to develop some agreement about how you can go forward in kind of a small way, piece by piece. I don't think there is any one big graphic solution that will resolve these problems. And the Tribal Law and Order Act, arguably, and we'll have to see through the test of time, it's a small step in the right direction. The amendments to the Violence Against Women Act, which provide tribal courts for the first time in the modern era to potentially have jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who commit sexual offenses related to domestic violence in Indian country. I think a lot of people see that as a big step forward. And then we'll just have to see empirically, does it really work? Is public safety as a result of these two statutes? And it'll take time, 5-10 years, to get an idea. Is it really achieving the objective that those statutes have? It's just like any law passed by any sovereign. Yeah, it has like a good goal in mind, arguably good motivation, but we never know. I mean, we're imperfect to see if it actually works. And so in the context of those two statutes, we're at the front end of people generally agreeing that they're good things, and everybody believing or hoping that they're when and as they are implemented, that they will be successful, and again, in the context of advancing public safety in Indian country.
We've got about a minute left here. The Biennial Indian Law Symposium at the USD School of Law gets underway tonight with Brendan Johnson's talk, and then panel discussions open to the public for the rest of the week? Or?
Yeah, there'll be two on Thursday. The one Thursday morning will be on the Tribal Order Act itself. The one tomorrow afternoon, Thursday afternoon, will be about advancing, protecting women in Indian country, largely focusing on the amendments to the Violence Against Women Act. And then the final panel on Friday morning will be in the context of tribal-state relations in the context of public safety in Indian country. And one other thing I did want to mention perhaps quickly, Carl, is that there's a luncheon tomorrow, generally open to the public, and the Native American Law Student Association, the University of South Dakota Law School, will be honoring one of its graduates, Jenny Fighton, a very wonderful, excellent student and attorney in the area of Indian law who passed away over the holidays during Christmas. And so there'll be a special honoring for her as well.